helicopter.
Hey, we can do helicopters.
Yeah. How you doing today?
I am doing great.
What's the weather like down there?
Starting out about 34 this morning, supposed to get up into the 60s. We should be in mid to upper 70s by Tuesday.
Did you have any weather yesterday?
Yeah, we did. We had terrible winds, a little rain, and then the day before we had a lot of wind. I mean 40, 50 mile an hour winds.
Yeah, we had snow up here. Oh, it started Saturday night, and you know, it wasn't a lot of snow, but it covered the ground, and wind was blowing 40 mile an hour.
Yeah, I don't do snow. That's the reason I moved from Idaho to Texas.
Cindy, I'm hearing a buzz in the background. Is that okay?
That's in the board.
Okay.
We're not going to hear it when we go.
Okay. So, Larry, where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Oregon.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Lived in Idaho for about 25 years, and once I got enough money amassed and everything to move south where there was no snow and no real cold weather, I'm not from Texas, but I got here as soon as I could.
I understand. Now, where were you living at the time you went into the Army?
I was living in Bend, Oregon.
Okay. Now, tell me, you know, you and I both are from the era, the Vietnam era, and back in those days, we didn't get to choose whether we went or whether we didn't, and they had what they called the draft, and we were told we were going to go, so we went. How old were you at that time?
I was 17.
Okay, right out of high school?
Right out of high school. It's a family tradition in our family. We consider going into the military and serving this country a privilege, not a responsibility or a job. It's a privilege to join the service.
Right.
And everybody, my son, my brother, my grandfather, my dad, everybody has been in the military. And when I got out of high school the following March, I was off to basic training. It's just the way we did things.
Sure. My family was Marine Corps. And, you know, I had gone to college. I was kind of the same mindset. It was a privilege to go, and I wanted to go, but at the same time, I was hesitant, and I ran my student deferment out as long as I could going to college, and at that point in time, I found there's no more deferment, so I'm going to go, and I chose to go to the Marine Corps. Like I said, my family pretty much had all been Marines, so that's why I ended up going to the Marine Corps, but so many people were unlike you and unlike I, nobody really, or I would guess 80% of the people did not want to go, because unlike World War II, they were backed up at the recruiting stations after the Japanese had bombed us in Pearl Harbor. But Vietnam, there were a lot of protesters and people that didn't want to go. So what you're telling me is that you went because you wanted to go and you felt it was an honor to serve your country.
Yes, I did. And you know, and I still feel that way. When I first got out of Vietnam, I came back to Oakland, California, to get my discharge. And it took me 6-7 months to understand what was going on, because I'm the type of a military guy that I probably got more personal pride in this country than anybody walking the earth. And to see these people throwing eggs and bricks and stuff at buses full of GIs that had went to Vietnam to fight for what our president thought was right. And I'm not going to get into politics. I don't care if it was right, wrong, or indifferent. It was our job. That's what we signed up for. We don't make the decisions. Our government makes the decisions. We follow them. And it took me a long time to try to justify what I did. And then I finally came to the conclusion that what I did was right. It was ethical. I did it the best I could do. I had a lot of fellas die over there that I put in the air that was doing the same thing I did. And it took a long time to justify that. And I think in the late 60s, early 60s, late 60s, when Vietnam got going, I think America lost a lot of its personal pride.
I would agree with you on that.
I think there was too many gimme programs, you know, the welfare and everything else. People were allowed to get away with stuff that, you know, we just weren't allowed to do in the 40s and 50s. When I grew up, I mean, everybody worked. Everybody had a job. Nobody paid for nothing from the government. What you had is what you earned. And I think this country has gotten away from that. They want a chicken and a check in every mailbox, and they want to sit on their butt and watch Judge Judy every day, and that's all they want out of life.
Well, and I would agree with you, and I think we're seeing a real transition in this country right now, particularly with the last election, and we're seeing it being kind of controlled by those that have not, that want a handout and don't want to work. And you know, I think democracy is kind of causing us to go from the have-nots, or from the haves, those that are willing to work, to those that don't want to work. And that's, in my mind, what got Obama reelected, was those people that got out and voted that didn't have anything. And it, well, the entitlements, they want it, they just soon have you give it to them as have to work for it.
Well, and that's exactly right. And, you know, you have to give Obama credit for one thing. He's a very smart man. He knows there's more people out there that want to sit on their butt and do nothing than there is that actually have enough personal pride in themselves and their country to go out here and work for it. So those are the people he targeted and was very good at it.
Yeah. Now, what year would you have got out of high school?
I got out in 64.
Okay. And at that point in time, we were in Vietnam, but we really hadn't got into it as heavy as we eventually did get into it.
Right. I went over in 65. I loved to fly. I wanted to be an astronaut.
Really?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
I tried to go in the Air Force, in the Marine Corps, in the Navy. I tried everything, and I grew up on a cattle ranch.
Uh-huh.
Excuse me. And in those days, to be an astronaut, the government would have sent me to college. That wasn't a problem. But I couldn't pass the physical because at that time I had problems with my teeth, and I had too many broken bones, and you had to be a perfect human specimen to withstand the rigors of going into outer space. And, mm-hmm. and it's since long since changed, you
yeah.
know. I mean, shoot, they're sending 75-year-old people up there.
Right, right.
But when I found out that I couldn't become a pilot and be an astronaut, I said, well, you know, the old saying in the Army is they'll take you sick, lame, or lazy.
Yeah.
And yeah. I said, I'll bet you they'll take me.
Yeah.
Well, and I ended up as a door gunner and a platoon sergeant in Vietnam because mm-hmm. I was a diesel mechanic.
Yes.
In stationed in Schofield Barracks in Hawaii.
Yeah.
And the Vietnam deal come up. We were going over as advisors. And I just decided that, hey, I can do that. And so I took all the training. And I think in Schofield Barracks we had like 25,000 applicants, and they took 10.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I ended up number one out of the 25,000. I'm very, very accurate with a gun. And with my patriotism and everything else, my little brother was going to dental school at Fort Sam Houston. He was in the Army at the same time.
Uh-huh.
Well, a couple years later. But they were shipping people out of Fort Sam Houston just as fast as they could get them out of boot camp. And I volunteered to go to Vietnam so that he didn't have to, because he's a big old boy, but he just kind of carries his feelings on his shirt sleeve, and I didn't think he'd do good over there.
Mm-hmm.
So I volunteered for what they call them shotgunners, a shotgun platoon to go over in 1965.
Mm-hmm.
And I stayed there until my brother got out of the service. and had totally had intentions of making a career out of the military.
Uh-huh.
And the last time I got shot, I don't know, it was hard to get back in that helicopter.
Well, I understand. You and I have a similar background. I grew up southeast of Dodge City we had a cow herd and wheat farmer. So, you know, I think us country kids kind of have a little bit of an understanding about what real life is all about and how it all is put together. And you work every day. You didn't go out and expect somebody to provide for you. You worked for what you got. Now, you were shot. How many Purple Hearts do you have?
Two.
Two of them. Okay. And now you were a gunner on a helicopter.
Yes, I was.
Now, the helicopter was what kind of a helicopter?
It was a UH-1B gunship.
Now, what does that? Is there something out there today? I went over to Germany in 2000 and we entertained the Apache helicopter troops. It would be something bigger than an Apache. Is that correct?
No. The helicopter, the UH-1B helicopter, is their predecessor was a Huey Cobra.
Okay.
We had two flex guns on each side and 14 rockets, 2.75-inch rockets.
Uh-huh.
And then the door gunner had a machine gun and the crew chief had a machine gun. They were basically the very first flying gun platform that started, you know, they went from the Cobra to the Apache. And, I mean, the Apache, I would give anything to go for a ride in Apache helicopter.
Well,
I've been in the Cobra. Never, you know, when I left Vietnam, the Cobra was just coming to Vietnam.
Uh-huh.
But Huey was actually a 120-knot flying gun platform is all it was.
So now, is that what I would see in watching some of the movies that have the doors on either side with the guns sticking out?
Yeah,
and that
our
kind of
doors
thing?
Were off. If you've ever watched
right.
Apocalypse Now,
yeah.
When they attacked that island the first time with the guns and the rockets, that's a Huey gunship.
Yeah, okay. Now, at the time that you got your award, the Distinguished Flying Cross, what I was reading here, there was a Chinook that was down that you were going to help or rescue. Is that correct?
Yes. The Chinook had been shot down, and it had quite a few dignitaries on it. We were studying the effects of tear gas. They were trying to drop tear gas and adjust the fuses on tear gas out of 55-gallon barrels so it would blow up. And, you know, tear gas is heavier than air, so it'll
mm-hmm.
sink.
Mm-hmm.
And they were trying to adjust the length of the fuse to get everything correct because we had a couple big missions coming up and they were going to use the tear gas. And some rice farmer down there with a 30-30 or 30-06 just happened to hit the number one, number two hydraulics and
yeah.
put them in a bomb crater.
And so they were on the ground and you guys were kind of flying cover trying to keep the enemy away from them and get them rescued. Is that correct?
Exactly. We had them. This firefight went on into the evening, but we had them actually turn their military flashlights straight in the air.
Uh-huh.
And the Viet Cong was so close to this bomb crater that these guys were hiding in that I was actually trying to shoot their flashlights.
I see. Uh-huh.
They had Viet Cong within 25, 30 yards of them. And we actually repelled and saved everybody. Nobody got shot.
Well, that's fantastic. Did they have anyone on the ground that was returning any fire?
Just their personal weapons that they carried in the helicopter.
I see. Now, tell me about your gun jammed, or the bolt blew up as I was reading this. And you were unable to operate your weapon, is that correct?
Yes. We have a backup weapon. It's an M14.
Right.
And I had run out of ammunition for it, you know, because when your machine gun blows up, then you go to your personal weapon.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to fire something on the ground to keep
mm-hmm.
those boys' head down. And it just wasn't sufficient enough to repel the attack.
Well, and you probably ran out of ammunition rather quickly.
Yeah, I did. We carried like 100 rounds for the M14.
Right, right.
And that was in case you got shot down. And you know, you used 99 rounds at the enemy and saved one for yourself.
I understand. Now, but you were able to go out on the other side to the other machine gun that was over there. You took your safety belt off, you went out, and you got the bolt out of the other machine gun that had ran out of ammunition, as I remember.
Yeah, it had actually jammed what it had done, right. And there was no way to clear it. But those guns that we used, they're called flex guns on the outside that the co-pilot controlled.
Mm-hmm.
Those were the same exact gun that I had that I used, you know, fired from my shoulder.
Right.
And I just went out and tore it apart and got all the parts that I needed, put my gun back together, and I was back in action.
And that took you, what, not very long?
Not any longer than I had to be out there. I would say it seemed like I was out there for an hour with all those guys shooting at us, but I would say it probably took a minute, minute and a half.
Yeah. And so in doing all of this, they decided that they would award you the Flying Cross, is that?
Yes, it's Distinguished Flying Cross.
Distinguished Flying Cross. And this date of action was June 14, 1966.
Right.
Okay. And now where was this Chuchai base camp?
It's Kuchi.
Kuchi,
it's just south of Saigon.
Okay. And the Hobo
Woods.
Hobo Woods.
That's the birthplace of the Viet Cong. It's south of Kuchi. Kind of southwest over towards Benoit.
Okay. Okay. Now, obviously, this is not the only action that you saw.
Oh, my God, no.
And you were in Vietnam 13 months?
Yeah, I was over there twice. I went over twice.
Okay.
You know, I wanted to stay in until my little brother got out of the Army.
Uh-huh.
And so I volunteered to go back.
Okay.
And I had to go back to Hawaii and go back to my regular MOS, which was a diesel mechanic.
Okay.
And the problem was that 29 days after I got back to Hawaii, the whole 25th Infantry Division shipped back to Vietnam.
Uh-huh.
So when I got back to Vietnam, you know, I was fairly well respected as a door gunner and a platoon sergeant in the air, and it didn't take me long to get back in the air.
Okay.
There was a lot of folks that wanted me, so...
Now, when you say a platoon sergeant, and that would make you an E5 at that time?
Yes, I was.
Okay.
Now, commonly known as a buck sergeant.
Right. That the people that run the Army.
Yeah, exactly. That's it.
And so after you went back, though, you saw more action over there gunner on a helicopter.
I logged on an average of 18 hours of flight time a day.
Okay. Now, when you were a gunner and having to do a lot, had it ever become necessary, could you have flown that helicopter?
Yes, sir. Our pilots, I had some great, great pilots, and I actually had accumulated about 288 hours of stick time in the helicopter. And basically, I wasn't a pilot, but if the pilot and co-pilot got killed, I could fly that helicopter and put it on the ground.
Right. Now, was there some kind of protection, like plating, armor plating or anything on the bottom of those helicopters? Because obviously anybody on the ground shooting at the helicopter is going to be shooting up, which the first place is going to go through is the bottom. Any armor plating or anything under there?
No, there was not. We had a flak vest
that...
you know, was very heavy, weighed like 45 pounds.
Right.
That you put on, strapped it on with Velcro straps, and would cover your chest area.
Yeah.
I was not worried about getting killed in Vietnam. I mean, I wasn't out there to get killed, but I wasn't worried about getting killed.
Right.
And therefore, I took my flak vest and I sat on it.
Mm-hmm.
I had other things that were more important to me at 18 years old than my lungs and heart.
Yeah, you didn't want to get shot in the butt, right?
Exactly.
Right.
Or parts thereof.
Right. I understand. Now, But it says here that you released, or you you removed your safety belt, or let me see where it says. You removed his safety belt and rearmed a right. Now, normally, that helicopter, when you're flying in combat and that kind of thing, it's not just flying straight, level, and easy. It's didoing. And so you have, when you're in there as the gunner, you have something that strapped you in so you're not going to fall out.
Right. What we had was a 3-inch seat belt that you adjusted in length so that you could jump out of that helicopter. And on your way out, you kind of give your body a twist, and right behind your knees and on your butt would land on the skids.
Mm-hmm.
The most vulnerable part of that helicopter is the bottom of it. Well, mm-hmm. if you're flying directly over somebody, you can't shoot underneath the helicopter.
Right, right.
So if you had somebody underneath the helicopter, you adjust your seatbelt so that you could jump out, just actually jump out of the helicopter and turn, land on those skids, and shoot straight down underneath the helicopter, because with the flex guns and rockets, there was a dead spot there that you couldn't cover.
Right, right.
And that seatbelt, it's hard to fall out of a helicopter. It really is. When it's flying, the wind that comes in the doors will actually push you in the helicopter.
Right. There's a lot of torque coming down off those blades.
Yeah, there really is. And we never worried about falling out. But that seatbelt was so that you could jump out and turn and shoot underneath the helicopter, protect yourself as you broke from a gun run and flew off into the ozone.
Right. So about what speed would they have been traveling going over a target? I'm sure they can vary that speed.
Yeah,
faster
on
the
gun
slower.
Runs, we would usually, when the pilot would halt or brake, we were at max speed, which was around 120 knots. When I went outside the helicopter, I asked the pilot to try not to do anything exotic.
Right.
Because I had no seatbelt on, and those gun pylons that stick off those helicopters are round. They're aluminum, titanium. They're very slick. And I was straddled that thing with my legs locked, and I could just imagine myself sliding over and turning upside down and be hung there until we landed.
Right.
And that just didn't seem like the kind of ride I wanted to be on.
Well, probably couldn't have done what you needed to do if you'd have had all that restraint on you anyway.
I couldn't reach it.
Yeah.
It was too short for me to get to the back of that machine gun to tear it apart.
Right. Now, let me ask you a question real quick, and I don't want to get off this subject, but a lot of interest and a lot of attention these days to PTSD and that kind of thing. And last year for Marine Corps birthday, we brought a man in who had written a book called Walking the Point, and he had spent several years after he got back battling PTSD, in fact, almost thought about committing suicide, and didn't. And then he kind of figured out a way to deal with the post-traumatic stress and all of that kind of thing. And he spent a lot of time now trying to help other folks with post-traumatic stress. Have you, in your reflection back, have you had any problem at all with post-traumatic stress, PTSD?
No, and I think a lot of that come from growing up on the farm, from my parents teaching me how to deal with different situations, teaching me to mentally adjust to what you were doing, what you had to do, and doing it not because you wanted to do it, but it had to be done.
Uh-huh. Exactly.
And I think I was just mentally stronger and able to justify what I was doing better than some other folks. Now, I'm personally familiar with some friends that actually cracked up and, you know, needed some psychological help to adjust. I didn't know what I would do.
Right. Well, you know,
I was faced with the situation where I had to shoot another human being.
Right. And
well,
it was
that
was what
it
was
happened,
expected.
You are so as you know, in the military, so well trained that your mind goes on automatic pilot when you get into a firefight. And I took action, did what I had to do, and never even thought about it till I landed on the ground.
Right. And, you know, I suppose had you been of the kind that would have sat there and thought about it, you probably wouldn't have come back alive.
Yeah, exactly. You're exactly right. But, you know, it all boils down to it's me or him, and I wasn't ready to go.
Right. And I that would be my situation. It's not my time, guy. It's yours.
Yeah, exactly.
And I remember as a kid growing up after World War II, people talking about folks that had come home that were shell-shocked. Well, obviously that was PTSD. We didn't call it that at that time. But some folks in some ways have a tougher time dealing with that as they sit and reflect back on it. I think part of the problem of getting over it is just don't stop and think back about it. Don't reflect on it. Just go ahead with your life. And, you know, what's past is past. You can't change it, so why dwell on it?
Yes. I had an uncle that was, in those days, considered shell-shocked.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a tough time. Ended up going through alcoholism and,
right,
and everything else. And I don't know. I guess I just looked at life different than some of those other folks. And, you know, I'm not trying to take anything away from them or anything else.
Right.
I mean, it's just different strokes for different folks. And it's the way your mind is able to adjust to a given situation and digest everything that's going on and put it in its proper place.
Right. I would agree with you 100% on that. Let's go back a little bit to your time in Vietnam. Were you ever in any combat on the ground?
Yes, I was shot down 9 times.
Okay. And did you have to fight your way back to,
yes, I did,
to safety?
Yes, I did.
Okay. And a lot of that time when you were having to fight your way back, you were on the move trying to get away from where you had landed and get back to the lines that there was help and people. What were some of the odds that you faced?
I'll tell you, there is nobody in this world. The thing that scared me worse when I was on the ground than the Viet Cong,
uh-huh,
was snakes.
Oh, yeah. Me too.
Believe it or not, I'm in a combat situation where another human is trying to kill me, and I'm crawling through the jungle and scared to death of a damn snake.
Well, I hate snakes.
If it ain't got feet, it don't belong here.
I would agree with you there. Yeah. But now, did you ever encounter any
oh, yes,
snakes? And there are a lot of venomous snakes over there. Right?
Yes. The Tonsonut runway, the first time I went over, I flew with the 120th Aviation, the Razorback Hogs. And it's patrolled by canine.
Mm-hmm.
And we had one cobra that, I mean, it had to stretch from Dallas to Alba, Texas. I'd never seen a snake that long in my life. And it bit that dog. And at that time, they had used all the cobra venom they had to try to save that dog's life,
uh-huh,
because they said it would have cost over $50,000 to train enough troops to take his place.
Right.
But we had bamboo vipers, we had crates, we had all kinds of wigglies over there that weren't right.
Did you try to make noise to get them to kind of know you was coming and get out of your way?
No, you couldn't.
Yeah.
Because now you're alerting the Viet Cong.
That's exactly right.
And they're behind every darn bush, and they're like gophers over there. You know, they just pop out of holes that you
right,
didn't even know were there.
Right.
So my senses especially was really on alert.
Mm-hmm. So when were you discharged? What year were you discharged?
January 17th, 1967.
Okay. Tell me about your first experience when you got home and came back and encountering any. Did you encounter, I guess that would be the first question, did you encounter any of the flower children, the peace demonstrators, and all of that kind of thing?
The first thing that I seen when I got off the bus at Oakland was a lady that was pregnant with this tie-dyed T-shirt on with a hole cut out around her belly that says, I have been pollinated. And I thought that was funny until she started calling us baby killers and warmongers. And I was called everything that you could think of. I stayed in my house for about 3 months until my hair grew out so that people did not know I was in the service. And that is one of the saddest points in my life, is to come back. And I didn't come back wanting a ticker tape parade or nothing else. I just wanted to be treated like a human being, and we weren't.
And I think, Larry, I think a lot of that goes back to what we talked about earlier. We went because we were told, our country said go. We didn't question that our country told us to do it. We just obeyed. And I guess that's kind of where I was coming from. It wasn't necessarily something that I really relished doing, but I did it because I was told to do it, and I did it to honor my country. And then I come back and I find that the country isn't wanting to honor me for doing what they asked me to do.
You know, a good example of how I feel, I got politely told to shut up at a VFW meeting. They were pushing to get the Vietnam Memorial. I was dead set against the Vietnam Memorial. Now, I have 95 guys that were killed under me that I picked their name to fly a mission. They didn't come home.
Mm-hmm.
The reason that I was dead set against the Vietnam Memorial is, why should veterans from Vietnam get any more respect than guys from World War I, World War II, or the Korean conflict? Why should we be singled out to have a memorial when they have nothing but the Arizona sitting in Pearl Harbor? When those boys get rewarded, then we'll take our turn and they can build a wall.
Well, I think in my mind that they all should be rewarded. World War I, World War II, Korea, even the guys, the young men and people that are having to go over to Afghanistan and Iraq and those places.
You betcha. And they're getting their just reward now. But in those days,
right,
they were trying to cover up the fact that the United States people really screwed up the way they treated their veterans coming back from Vietnam, and they were trying to pass it over. Well, when the other guys that made this country the way it is, they need their just reward too. And I was all about building a memorial for the guys that served on Omaha Beach or Gold or any of the beaches in World War II. When they got their memorial, then it would be our turn to get our memorial. Right. Until then, I was not for the Vietnam Memorial.
And, you know, that's one of the things that we're trying to do here with all of these interviews. I've got a couple of men who were World War II or survivors of the Battle of the Bulge, and I want to get them in here and hear their story. They saw combat at the Battle of the Bulge. They need to get their stories out so people can start to recognize the service that so many of these people throughout all of our history have paid. And a memorial is great, but the stories need to be told so people understand what these people went through. It's not like getting up and going to work at the bank at 8 o'clock in the morning or anything else like that.
You look at the guys in Korea that fought in sub-zero weather with no food, no ammunition. They didn't have anything. At least in Vietnam, we didn't have to freeze to death.
Yeah.
And we fought a different war in Vietnam. You were told when I left, I was so disappointed, you couldn't shoot unless you were shot at. Well, if I walk into a nightclub and somebody wants to take a poke at me and there's no way to get out of it, I'm throwing the first blow.
Yeah.
I don't want to be on my butt and say, wow, I guess the fight's on.
Yes.
You know, I was so disappointed in Lyndon Johnson when when we went to Vietnam, Vietnam should never, ever have went the way it went.
I would agree with you.
When you're in a combat situation, let's go over there. We're the biggest, baddest boys on the block. Let's take this little country the size of California and get rid of it, and let's all go home and go back to our jobs.
Go over and concrete it and come back.
Exactly. Or make a glass factory out of it. I don't care what they did with it. But
you know, you were talking about the people in Korea. I have a man that I'm going to try and get to interview who lives up in Russell, who was at the Chosin Reservoir and fought his way out 20 and 50 below zero. They called for some of the guns they had were the shells. They referred to them as Tootsie Rolls. They were running out. They called for more Tootsie Rolls. The next day, they dropped Tootsie Rolls. But he said it was a blessing because their food was all frozen and they could eat those Tootsie Rolls.
Exactly. And, you know, combat, the military itself has come so far in taking care of their troops. Those guys had it rough.
Oh, yeah. Now,
I mean, we have no idea.
No, we have none.
The people nowadays, it's just like if we went into a depression right now, I would venture to say that 50% of the people in the United States would jump out of a four-story building because they couldn't grow a damn tomato plant.
Right.
And take care of themselves, you know. Well, those people had to.
Yeah.
But they grew up in a different era.
Well,
they knew how to take care of themselves with nothing because they had never had nothing.
Well, and the thing that they had that, to me, signifies their importance, they had pride in what they were doing. And you know, in World War II, we had pride in the fact that we were serving what we thought was an honorable cause. The people in Korea that were fighting, they had pride. You know, those people coming down out of the Chosin Reservoir brought their dead and wounded, not because they were proud and they wanted to bring them home. They weren't going to leave them behind. And I think this country in so many ways today has lost a lot of that pride in our country and in our service.
And in ourselves.
That's where it begins. That would be the beginning of it. Let me ask you, Cindy's given me some questions here. You were shot 9 times, you said.
Yes.
Okay. Do you have any other awards other than the Purple Hearts?
I've got Distinguished Flying Cross.
Yeah.
Let me look up here. I can't remember them all.
Right.
I got all kinds of
Can
things.
You still get in your uniform?
Oh, yeah.
Really?
You betcha. After when I got back, in fact, my uniform, I'm sitting here looking at it. I've got a big one of these shadow boxes with all my awards in it. Some of my favorite pictures of my crew chiefs. And, I'm looking here at all kinds of stuff on this uniform.
Well, what you might do after we get done, you might make a list of those and get them up to Cindy, because then we can kind of incorporate those into when Cindy gets this all edited and put together.
There you go.
Okay. Now, what do these awards mean to you? If you can briefly.
I don't even know how to. I guess the best way, every time I look at that uniform, it almost brings tears to my ears or to my eyes with just pride and joy, knowing that I had a job to do and I did it the very best I could.
Yeah. Now, she also would like to know why you weren't afraid to die. Or were you?
No, I was not. I was over there doing something that my government asked me to do, and when I signed on, I knew that I could get killed. I had already justified that in my mind. Death is forever, and when you get shot with a gun, usually it's instantaneously. Therefore, there was going to be no pain, no suffering, no nothing. Just go do your job. I had 3 other guys' lives that depended on me doing my job. If you were afraid to die, you had better not get in the military.
Right, exactly.
And that was just part of the job. I'm pretty headstrong, and I didn't let things like that bother me. I can honest to God say I never one time got scared while I was in the air.
Mm-hmm.
I got scared when I was on the ground.
Right.
After you had landed and had time to think about what you had just went through, you'd start shaking uncontrollably until you had a cold beer and said, okay, now that that's over, let's get back to our job.
But to do that, to go through all of that, you didn't have time to get scared.
No, you
didn't. You had to concentrate on what you were doing and doing your job, and there was no time there that being afraid could ever enter into it.
No, uh-uh. And like I say, you're so well trained that you flip that switch to automatic pilot, and there is your training takes over, and you just go through the motions of exactly what you were trained to do, and you do it.
Now, you volunteered to go so your brother wouldn't have to go over there. Did the two of you ever talk about that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And he thanks you, right?
My little brother and I are real close.
Uh-huh.
And he lives in Oregon in Salem. And I try to go up once a year, and we spend a week, 10 days playing golf and having a good time. And to this day, he's thankful for it.
Well, yeah. And you are, too.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I wouldn't change a single thing. The only thing that I would change is I would be a retired helicopter pilot right now because I would have stayed in.
Cindy would like to know, how do you transition from people popping out of the ground and snakes to being safe?
How do I do what now?
She said transition from, I assume, once you are getting through there and you have to worry about people popping out of the ground and snakes that's going to bite you and all that, when you get through all of that, how do you transition from that survival mode to all of a sudden saying, okay, I'm safe now?
It takes about 6 cold beers.
Okay. All right.
6 cold beers and some other CO saying, hey, you got to make out flight list for in the morning, and pretty quick you're just
back into the job.
Yeah. Well, today's done. Let's worry about tomorrow.
Now, you said that Vietnam vets have a bad rep, and they want to change that. How will you change them having that bad reputation? I think we're changing it right now. I think we're seeing a real change in a lot of the attitude of people that served during Vietnam and how people treat them today. I know a lot of times I might go somewhere and have my Marine Corps sweatshirt or T-shirt on, and people will ask, you know, what year, and I'll tell them that I'm a Vietnam-era Marine. And I have a lot of people say thank you for your service. We had a parade over in Dodge last year, and we had a float in there, Marine Corps Veterans of Western Kansas, and that whole route, Larry, that whole route, as we went by, stood and applauded. And there were lots of thank you. I think we're seeing a real change in the minds of people in this country right now to the respect that the Vietnam veteran didn't get to they're getting now. And I'd like your thoughts on that.
I think a lot of that stems from back in the Ronald Reagan days.
Mm-hmm.
And I really believe that people since Afghanistan and Kuwait, and my son was over in Kuwait.
Really?
He was a senior medic for the 101st Airborne.
Uh-huh.
And I think that people have come to realize exactly what a soldier goes through now.
Right.
And I think they're getting old. The flower children are gone, and I think they've all grown up and said, wow, that was a stupid point in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I think through knowledge of what those soldiers go through, I think they're turning around saying, hey, we were idiots back in the 60s. Yeah. And now that we're off the drugs and got a clear mind, I think we're starting to get the respect. I know I will not go anywhere if I see a soldier that I don't shake his hand. And I don't care if he's a mail clerk, a cook, or what he
You're
is.
Right.
He did his job, and I always walk up to him and say thank you. And it's amazing, in the last 8-10 years, people find out I had been in Vietnam, and it's amazing how many people shake my hand and say thank you. And
right.
You don't know how far a thank you goes in my mind, justifying what I did and what I went through, just to hear those words, thank you.
Well, and it means a lot. The one group, though, that I still am having trouble dealing with are the deserters that went to Canada and then they came back and Clinton gave them an amnesty. I still have a little bit of hard time feeling much for those people as having the rights, I guess, that the average veteran really has.
If I would have been Bill Clinton, those boys would still be in Canada, because to me, that is desertion.
Well, exactly.
And desertion, you either get out of this country or you get shot.
Yeah.
At least Muhammad Ali had, the gonads to, I ain't going. I'll go to jail.
Right.
At least he didn't leave the country.
Yeah. And
when you leave this country, if you're too good to fight for this country, you're too damn good to live in it.
Well, when you turn your back on your country, you disown it, and you disown something, you don't have a right to come back to it.
Exactly.
I feel the same way about Jane Fonda. I don't understand why we allow her to get the recognition and all of this that we do, but that's because I guess it's because it's a free country and people have the right to feel that way. Now, you said that you stayed inside your house for 3 months. And Cindy would like to know, how did you get out? Get out of the house, Cindy?
Yeah, how do you make yourself get out and start living?
Yeah, how did you make yourself get out and start living again after you'd stayed in there 3 months? You stayed in there for 3 months so your hair would grow out so you wouldn't have to face a lot of the ridicule.
I was so proud to come back to this country.
Right. And should have been.
And then to see all of this turmoil and the hate and discontent, it took me 3 months to justify in my mind that I did nothing wrong.
Right.
And once I felt that way, then it was easy. I walked down the street and I almost wanted to put my uniform on and say, hey, you bet. I'm one of them boys you don't like. Now, what are you going to do about it?
Right.
Well, it was just a matter of taking some time, learning how to not be on edge 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You know, you sleep with both ears open and one eye open. And justifying that what you did in your own mind fits your mentality or whatever you want to call it. And when I made that determination, I said, okay, I am fine.
And, you know, that might be, that very point might be, and probably there are a lot of psychologists that will disagree with what I'm saying, but that point right there, justifying in your own mind what you did was right, would be the beginning of being able to handle post-traumatic stress and that kind of thing.
That is what saved me, because...
Right.
I could see how, when I got back, the way people were treating me and everything else, the easiest thing to do would have been become an alcoholic and just drive off a bridge somewhere.
Right. Now,
that just wasn't in my program.
Now, Larry, what did you do when you got home? What was your profession? What career did you pursue?
I went into becoming a builder.
Okay.
I went to work for Crown Zellerbach to start out with in the logging industry, worked in a sawmill, and then worked as a tree climber, topping trees, setting up high rig logging equipment and stuff like that, and just gradually got into hunting and fishing, and I've made that my entire career ever since then.
So you were a lumberjack.
Oh, yeah.
You and Paul Bunyan.
Yeah, well, if you've seen me, I'm only about 5'10" and weigh 150 pounds, so not really a Paul Bunyan, but I could climb a tree. Everybody around here, I'm 67 years old, and people call me the monkey. There is no tree too tall or too big that I can't climb, knock the limbs down. And
yeah. So where do you live today?
I live in Alba, Texas.
And that's where?
We are 80 miles east of Dallas on Lake Fork.
Okay, okay. And what do you do?
I am a professional outfitter, bass fishing guide. I do elk hunts, hog hunts, deer hunts, duck hunts, and bass fish on Lake Fork.
I see. You know, I, as I told you, I grew up in the country southeast of Dodge City, and, you know, I used to never miss opening day of pheasant season. We still have a lot of pheasant, a lot of deer. Had a place right north of my farm. You could see on the distance the guy had a big herd of buffalo that he used to have people come out and hunt. He has since quit that. But he also had brought in some, I think they were Russian boar, and luckily they never got loose because they could have ruined our country. But
oh, yeah, we're fighting those hogs down here in Texas. Of course, my partner, I've got probably the only guy that I have ever been associated with that I could go into the business I'm in right now, and it's Luke Clayton. And I know Cindy knows him very well, but him and I just, I mean, this is a tough business to get into and do it right.
Mm-hmm.
But he's the only guy I've ever met that I could do this with. And it comes from hunting knowledge and trust. And there's a lot of different aspects into the outfit business. But
yeah.
We're really making it go good, and I am just having a ball doing it.
Now, are these feral hogs?
Yes,
yeah.
they sure are.
And they reproduce fast.
We've got billions of them.
Yeah, they can reproduce awfully, awfully fast. But now, so you are an outfitter.
Yes.
Live down in, where was it you live?
Texas.
Yeah, but what?
Alba, Texas. We're 80 miles east of Dallas. And
okay.
That's where we do our whitetail hunts, our hog hunts, and our duck hunts. And then I bass fish here in Texas. And then we elk hunt in Colorado. We've got private land in Colorado.
Okay. You know, I was driving to my farm one day, and, of course, there's not a lot of folks out there and not a lot of population, but it was rain, and I was driving down the road, and I saw in front of me, I thought it was a buckskin horse coming at me, and this is southeast of Dodge City. And as I got closer, it turned and went out into the field, and it was a cow elk.
Oh, yeah.
So we're getting a few of those around, but not like, I guess the elk originally was a plains animal anyway, and civilization drove them up into the mountains, so.
Well, you guys up there in that part of the country, I've got a lot of friends that are outfitters in Idaho and Wyoming and Montana.
Mm-hmm.
And you guys got a real bad problem with the wolves. I mean, it's putting a tremendous strain on the elk herds and the mule deer herds and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
And until those people learn to control those wolves that should have never been brought back into this part of the country, you better remember what that cow elk looked like, because there will come a day, if they don't do something here in the very near future, that those wolves will kill the last standing elk in that part of the western United States.
Well, PETA will make sure that happens.
Yeah, right.
Okay. No, they'll make sure that they kill the last one that we have.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's definitely true.
Yeah. Well, I don't know, Larry. You know, is there anything that you'd like to say before we conclude this? You know, I for one would like to say thank you for your service. We really appreciate it, and we want to get the stories out. I think that's one thing that we need to do for all of the veterans, is get more of the stories out so people understand the pride that they need to have in this country and in our military.
Well, I think that what you are doing is just so fantastic, and it's a reason that I wanted to be a part of it.
You're first.
I'm just one individual that, you know, was very fortunate to get out of Vietnam alive and in good shape. And I think that what you're doing will help the people of this country gain some personal pride in themselves and in that American flag. And I just want to say thank you to all the vets. I don't care what you did, where you've been. As long as you did your job and you got out of there with an honorable discharge, I want to say thank you to all of them.
And when you see that flag go by, take your hat off, stand at attention.
I get in more trouble at racetracks.
I do too.
I'm a big stock car fan. And when that flag is being presented and that national anthem is being played, you had better not be close to me if you've got something to say.
Well, and I go to a lot of sporting events, basketball games and those things, and it just drives me up a wall. They always play the national anthem, and those players standing down there jagging around and moving and all that kind of stuff, and I just want to walk up and slap them.
I have done it several times.
I've told coaches.
At stock car races, you know, hey, take your hat off and shut up.
I've told coaches you need to practice that. They need to stand
at
attention.
Well, it's on national television.
Yeah, yeah,
they
that's
don't,
right.
You know, personal pride is something that you got to pay attention, and you got to respect that flag. That flag signifies a whole bunch of folks.
But we have a spoiled generation.
I guess.
Cindy, is there anything more that you would like? Do you want to come over and ask?
No.
Okay.
Would
you take a picture of your shadow box, she asked.
Yes, I sure will.
And if you could get a list of the other awards that that you've got and that kind of stuff that we
okay.
can put into this.
Yeah, I'll take a picture of my uniform hanging up here in the shadow box and my award box, and I'll send it to Cindy.
Now, we can put that on the website, can't we, Cindy? How about a picture of you?
I don't know if I got a camera that'll do that.
Well, I'll bet we can find one somewhere.
Okay.
Maybe one of some of your military. I don't know if you have a website that is your personal website.
Yes, I do. It's huntingeasttexas.com.
And that guy, pictures of you in your Vietnam days and helicopters and that kind of stuff?
No, it doesn't have anything like that on there. I'm kind of funny. I normally don't go out and advertise the
understand.
Fact, you know, that, I mean, it just, that's long gone.
Right, but it's not forgotten.
Nope, so, I hope not.
Any pictures he has.
Yeah, you know, any pictures that Cindy might be able to use putting it on the website and things like that.
Okay.
All right. Hey, it's really good, you know, if you ever get around in the first part of November through January and you want to come and hunt a few pheasants or something, holler at me. I got places we can go.
I'll sure do it.
And if you got your partner down there that he wants to come, why, I will get you a shot. I won't guarantee that you'll hit it.
Oh, I'll hit it.
Okay. No, but you're welcome to come up anytime. And again, Larry, thank you for your service and thank you for your time this morning.
All right. And I appreciate what you're doing, Luke. And tell Cindy if she needs anything else just to give me a call, and we'll go from there.
Good enough. Thank
All
you.
Right. Thank you, Leonard.
Bye.
Bye.
There we go.
Well, hopefully you'll get 5 minutes out of that.
Oh, for Pete's sake. I could do a series of 12.